Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, happy Mother's Day to everyone. Always a beautiful day with Mom. And on the other hand, ran out of moms. We don't have any moms left around anymore. But our kid's mom is still around. And we'll celebrate with her and celebrate with all my daughters that are moms. And we'll continue our celebration of everything mom-related by a little essay by Genevieve Anderson from the Chicago Tribune editorials. Genevieve writes, "A day to thank Mom for everything. I can't help but be awe-inspired by the true meaning of that word, mother. The word demands a certain amount of respect, and as a matter of fact, the title is definitely well-earned. After all, to become a mother, one must take on the responsibility of sheltering a life for 9 months within one's own body. You must not only take care of yourself, but of the precious life within you. Every decision you make affects not only you at this point, but the life of an unsuspecting individual. To bear that kind of responsibility is exhausting, and to bear it for 9 months, a true challenge. That, however, I'm afraid, is the easy part. Once that 9 months is over, if all goes well or not, it is up to the mother to separate herself from the life she has clung to so tightly. The cord must be cut, and where there was one, there are now two very different people, the mother and the child. This is where the challenge begins. Mothering is as unique as a set of fingerprints. No two styles are the same, and you will never find two of a kind, for no one can tell someone how to be a mother. It is a job one must deal with on one's own. There is always a lot of advice to sift through, and sometimes there are lots of people to take over when you fail, but to succeed on one's own is a lifelong deed. If you are fortunate, you will realize the importance of your undertaking, and as your child grows, so too will you, learning with every challenge you must help that child face. The ultimate goal is to raise an independent individual, someone who can take care of himself or herself, stand on his or her own 2 feet confidently, securely, and happily. The stress you will undergo can only be understood by another mother. When people are grown and have lives of their own, it is the mother everyone always comes back to. What was your mother like? Some of us have buried our mothers before having children of our own. Some have not done that but have no relationship with her at all. Others are close with their mothers and take the journey together. Whatever the situation is, the mother is the key. The mother is the piece of the puzzle that glues your life together. She is responsible for teaching you the meaning of love, life, and self. It is to her we look when there are no answers. It is to her we go when life has lost its luster. It is to her we beg for attention, affection, and approval. It is she who demands our respect. She earned it. She deserves it. She needs it to survive. It is the only reassurance she has that she is doing a good job, that she is succeeding in her endeavor. If you are lucky enough to be able to, go to your mother and give her a hug. Let her know you appreciate her and all she has done for you. If things are not right between you and your mom, mend them. It's the least you can do. After all, think of all she has done for you. It isn't, wasn't, and never will be easy. So keep that in mind when you tell her, "Thank you, Mom." Whatever the situation, the mother is the key. The mother is the piece of the puzzle that glues your life together. Words of wisdom, isn't that true? Yeah, I wish I could say hi to my mom. Well, she's up there somewhere, hopefully listening. Hopefully correcting. Why did he do that? I'm sure that's what she's saying. That's what she always said. But Mother's Day. Who originated Mother's Day? Anna Jarvis, born in 1864, lived till 1948, from West Virginia. And she came up with this idea because she was concerned about the neglectful treatment of mothers by their adult children. Things haven't changed. The first American Mother's Day was May 10th, 1908. Flowers are traditional. Red carnations, a symbol of a living mom. White, when a mother has died. President Woodrow Wilson made it official. The second Sunday in May is always Mother's Day. And a couple thoughts from famous people, quotes about their moms, from Peter DeVries, the writer. A suburban mother's role is to deliver children obstetrically once, and by car forever after. All mothers are working mothers. From Oscar Wilde, of course, the great author. All women become like their mothers. That is their tragedy. No man does. That's his. Interesting. Sophia Loren. When you are a mother, you are never really alone in your thoughts. A mother always has to think twice, one for herself and once for her child. Marion Garrity, quoted in A Little Spoonful of Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul, says, "Mother's love is the fuel that enables a normal human being to do the impossible." The author Grace Harmon said, "My mom is a never-ending song in my heart of comfort, happiness, and being. I may sometimes forget the words, but I'll always remember the tune." Tenava Jordan, "A mother is a person who, seeing there are only four pieces of pie for five people, promptly announces, she never did care for pie." Being a full-time mother is one of the highest salary jobs, since the payment is pure love. From an unknown author who said, "A Freudian slip is where you say one thing but mean your mother." "A man's work is from son to son, but a mother's work is never done." An Irish proverb, "A man loves his sweetheart the most, his wife the best, but his mother the longest." Usually stays with him the longest, too. And a Jewish proverb, since we're non-denominational here, "God could not be everywhere, and therefore he made mothers." Isn't that so true? What about their jobs? Well, the most creative job in the world involves taste, fashion, decorating, recreation, education, transportation, psychology, romance, cuisine, designing, literature, medicine, handicraft, art, horticulture, economics, government, community relations, pediatrics, geriatrics, entertainment, maintenance, religion, email, law, accounting, energy, and management. And anyone who can handle all those has to be somebody special. And she is. She's a mom. Very true. Very true. Of course, if we still have a little time, you could sneak over to our friends over at Swirls, Pam Rose, down on 705 West Belden in Lincoln Park, for special Mother's Day cupcakes, gluten-free and vegan gluten-free. And I'm subscribing to the gluten-free mentality. The kids are now gluten-free, and I may have something to say about that. I had some at breakfast the other day. Nice breakfast. I enjoy breakfast on Sunday after Mass. Pork chops and eggs, or steak and eggs, or something like that. And I had a couple croissants with butter and a little marmalade, orange marmalade, which I like. And I went out to take a run that afternoon, and I tell you, a little sluggish. I wonder if it was because of the gluten in the bread. So, had lunch today with a good pal of mine, Pat Kinsella, old friend from Western Springs, who's now with the great construction firm Clune Construction. And, of course, we had our fish and chips, which we always do at the Gauge down at Michigan Avenue, right between Monroe and Madison. So our good Pat Doyle and the owner, Billy Lawless. And had fish and chips, enjoy fish and chips, but no bread. So we're going to kind of steer clear of that, I think. See how things work out. But anyway, nonetheless, strawberry shortbread cupcakes. Gluten-free, okay. Moist vanilla cake filled with fresh strawberry compote and cream cheese buttercream, topped with a white chocolate-covered shortbread cookie and strawberry buttercream. Mm. Or a chocolate-dipped raspberry red velvet cake filled with raspberry ganache, topped with cream cheese buttercream dipped in chocolate ganache. Swirls, because cupcakes make people happy. As for Pam Rose, mention her name. 705 West Belden, 773-404-2253. Or their website, Swirls, S-W-I-R-L-Z, cupcakes.com. Great cupcakes. I want to mention our friends over at Provision Theater. Another hit on the hands of Provision Theater because of the great and very talented Tim Gregory. Spoon River Anthology, of course, the world premiere adaptation of Edgar Lee Masters' classic work. This exciting new theatrical adaptation of Edgar Lee Masters' poetry explores the accounts of a fictional town's triumphs and failures and loves and losses based on the epitaphs from the town's gravestones. Don't miss this astonishingly stirring and emotionally satisfying offering. The dead, sleeping on the hill in their village cemetery, return to tell about their lives. Tales of war, poverty, religion, and marriage, among many other themes in this gossipy tale of Middle America in the early 20th century. It's through June 16th at the Provision Theater, which is located at 1001 West Roosevelt Road, kitty corner from St. Ignatius, across the street from UIC. And for information or tickets, 312-455-0066. We're going to have Tim on the show, I think, in a week or so, to chat a little bit about his success there, and another great show. And I think the 2013-2014 season is out again. Maybe we'll be able to touch on that a little bit. So that'll be fun. Of course, you'll be driving down Lakeshore Drive, and Buckingham Fountain is open again for the 86th season, operating daily from 8 to 11 through autumn, weather-dependent, of course. And during the season, the fountain produces a major display, shooting water from the center jet 150 feet into the air. The daily display begins at 9, and thereafter it is every hour on the hour. Beginning at dusk, the fountain's major display is accompanied by a 20-minute light and music show every hour on the hour. An additional and final display of the evening begins at 10:35. For more information, of course, call the Chicago Park District at 312-742-PLAY, P-L-A-Y, or visit their website, chicagoparkdistrict.com. We thank Marta Juanitza, of course, for always keeping us tuned in to what's happening with the Chicago Park District and all the great things that the parks are doing. Busy show today, some very interesting guests, and one of the great rock and rollers of all time, Jimmy Peterik from the Ides of March, who is going to be appearing with Herman's Hermits at the Paramount Theater, Saturday, May 18th at 8 o'clock. So we thought we'd feature his CD, The Ides of March, his first great hit, You Wouldn't Listen to Me. We'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show.
I told you he was a fool.
You wouldn't listen to me.
He'll break your heart.
You wouldn't listen to me.
He'll tear it apart.
You wouldn't listen to me.
So you better get smart.
You wouldn't listen to me. You wouldn't listen to me. You wouldn't hear what I got to say. You wouldn't listen to me. Now you have got to obey. You've got to obey.
Yeah. You better be true.
You
Well, I gave you plenty of warning. You wouldn't listen to what I say. Well, now you are in mourning. I say that you're in a mighty bad way.
One of the fun things about hosting my radio show is having the opportunity of making the acquaintance of some very interesting, talented, and fascinating people, and our next very special guest is just such a person. He's an award-winning entertainer who has spoken to us through his music and performances worldwide. We are all familiar with his work because the songs that he has sung have become standards that speak to each of us and just simply touch our hearts. Some of those compositions, like the one we just heard, You Wouldn't Listen to Me, the hauntingly beautiful love song L.A. Goodbye, the chart-topping hit Vehicle, and the Grammy Award-winning and Oscar-nominated song from the great Rocky movie Eye of the Tiger. The man whose distinctive vocal virtuosity has personified the essence of excellence in entertainment for audiences that span the generations. Enjoy a double bill of good old-fashioned rock and roll when Herman's Hermits, starring Peter Noon, and The Ides of March play Aurora's Paramount Theater Saturday, May 18th. Legendary 60s pop band Herman's Hermits, beloved by screaming teens thanks to big hits like I'm Into Something Good and Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, Herman's Hermits were dubbed the original British invasion band. Flash forward nearly 50 years and Noon and his band still perform more than 200 concerts a year. Their next Chicago area stop is Saturday, May 18th at 8 at the Paramount Theater, 23 East Galena Boulevard in downtown Aurora, in a strong double bill featuring the Ides of March, also known as the Boys from Berwyn, best known for their 70s hit Vehicle. See two legendary rock bands and one amazing night. Box office number is 630-896-6666. And on the line with us right now is one of the classic rock and rollers, our good friend, Mr. Jim Peterick. Jimmy, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you for having me, man. How are you feeling?
Really good, and certainly always a pleasure to have you on the show. And you still love it more than ever, don't you, Jimmy?
I wake up every day feeling I'm the luckiest cat in the world, you know? I roll out of bed, I walk a couple of doors over to my studio, I hit the red button and I start recording with my engineer Larry Millis, who's also a member of the Ides of March. I've known Larry since third grade, which is roughly 55 years.
Good Lord, wow.
Crazy stuff. And yeah, I appreciate every day of it.
You know, you're originally from Berwyn, Morton West High School, what they named a street after you and everything else, and originally the Shondells.
Boy, that's going back. That was, you know, the original four from the Shondells, me, Larry Millis, Bob Berglund, and Mike Borch, that is still the nucleus of the Ides of March. We had to change our name from the Shondells after Tommy James came along.
Oh, yeah, right.
All the nerve. and we already had records pressed out as the Shondells, so we had to do some scrambling. And we were reading Shakespeare at the time, and Bob said, how about the Ides of March? And we all go, yeah! Sounds right.
Well, the English teacher that was there enjoyed that.
Exactly.
You know, we just played that song, of course, one of the great songs, and I always loved the L.A. Goodbye. That's a great song because you had some time in L.A., but you did a lot of different things. You know, you toured with Hendrix, and you toured with Joplin and Led Zeppelin especially, and it was a whole different avenue from the south side of our city here.
Yeah, you know, of course, we couldn't have had a better year to have a number one record than 1970. I mean, talk about rich rock and roll that year. As you said, we opened up for Zeppelin a number of times, Hendrix, Janis Joplin, the Grateful Dead, all too many times for my liking. nothing against them. They just played so darn long. One time they played so long we had to cut our set short. We had to cut Vehicle out of the set. That was not good. not good. But it was just a great, great time. And here we were, like 19 years old, 20 years old, touring around the country with our heroes and, you know, partying with them, not in the sense that people talk about partying now. We're talking about, you know, backstage with sandwiches and Cokes, you know.
Sure.
Those were really good times.
Now, you remember the movie Almost Famous. Was it similar to that was going on then?
Well, I never, you know, stood at the top of a building and said, I am a golden god. But other than that, you know, a lot of that was, I mean, that was patterned after Led Zeppelin, from what I heard. And we did, we were invited to one huge party that Jimmy Page threw with all the guys at the top of their penthouse after the Winnipeg show. And we walked in and we walked out. You know, I mean, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't especially like what was going on. We were very straight, by the books, homegrown Berwyn guys, and we went across the street and had some donuts.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, then in the 70s, you still had the Ides of March in your heart, but you tried some different things very successfully, of course, with Eye of the Tiger.
I left, well, the Ides of March, in essence, split up in 73, and we had got a little discouraged. You know, our second two albums on RCA failed to really make a dent, and we split up. And I thought, my feeling was that I was going to try to be the next Cat Stevens, Paul Simon. You know, I was enamored with those artists.
Mm-hmm.
I had an album in 76 called Jim Peterik, Don't Fight the Feeling on Epic, and again, did not chart. And at that point, I go, you know what? I want to put together the ultimate rock band. I miss a band. And that's when I found the members and created Survivor. This is late 1977. Had two records on Scotty's, and then magically got the call that changed my life.
How did that come up?
Stallone.
Yeah, how did that come back? Sylvester Stallone contacted you, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I got home one day. I lived in LaGrange at the time. Picked up or pressed my answering machine. Heard a couple of boring messages, and then I hear, "Hey, yo, Jim, give me a call." Out of the blue, never talked to the man in my life.
Really?
Not his secretary, him.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know what? Somebody's pulling a joke on me. You know, I really, really didn't believe it. And I called back that number, and he answers, "Hey, yo." And I go, "Is this Sylvester?" And he goes, "Call me Sly." And, you know, Frankie's on the other line, and we're taking notes furiously about this new movie he's got called Rocky III. And, you know, he wanted something new, something for the kids, something with a pulse. Okay, I think we could do that. And the rest is history.
Wow, that was a big, big hit for you.
You know, it was number one for 7 weeks on Billboard. It's gone on to sell about 30 million records.
And nominated for an Academy Award. That's huge.
Yeah, didn't win. We were sitting in the audience with egg on our face as they read off, "Love, Lift Us Up Where We Belong."
Well, you know what? Just by virtue of the fact you were there, you've won.
Well, yeah, nomination is great. In the Grammy, we really actually did land a Grammy and a People's Choice Award. I'm very thankful for all of that.
And then you got back together with the Ides of March.
Yeah, 1990. We got an offer from Berwyn, our hometown, to reunite for the big summer fair in Berwyn. And those used to be huge fests.
Oh, sure.
Pulled in, you know, 10,000 people. Well, we decided to blow the rust off and restore the vehicle, as it were. Rehearsed for 3 months for what we thought at the time was one show. Got together, played Berwyn, 25,000 people screaming, going crazy. And we go, you know, this is too much fun. And since 1990, we've been together the second time around way longer than the first time and just loving every year.
And one thing I want to mention, too, Jimmy, is the fact that you're the kind of guy, as are the Ides of March, that give back to the community. You're always involved, and you've been involved on a regular basis around Christmas time at Holy Name Cathedral, singing and so forth and entertaining. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, we love to give back, just like you said. And you know, Holy Name is a tradition every Christmas Eve, and we have a CD called Sharing Christmas that we always plow the profits back into the Thursday Suppers campaign with the church there. I'm heavily involved with the Special Talents America, giving chances to challenged teenagers and adults who have special needs and special talents. It's always something. I always play almost every year for the San Miguel schools, for the underprivileged. It makes you feel good.
Sure.
You do something.
Sure, sure. When you were growing up and you were honing your craft, not that every day isn't a new challenge, and certainly you're refining things even as we speak, I suppose, but who did you look up to? Who did you gravitate towards those guitar players, or did you gravitate towards the singers? Who were you kind of mentors to you?
Sure. Well, my original inspiration was Elvis Presley.
Sure.
I was only 4 or 5 years old, but my sisters were older and, you know, would bring home these records on Sun Label and then RCA, and I would just be mesmerized. The Beatles were probably my next role models. I mean, who wasn't influenced by the Beatles?
Yeah.
You have to be raised in Mongolia or something. and then, you know, I really gravitated towards the horn bands. You know, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Of course, we were contemporaries of Chicago and loved all that. But the underlying thing, Kevin, was the songwriters. And that, to this day, I'm inspired by great songwriters like Paul Simon, Carole King, Jerry Goffin. The great teams of the 50s and 60s, Lieber, Stoller, Bacharach, David, were my heroes. So I always think it always starts with a great song. No matter what style it is, no matter what you go through, it's the song that sets the tone.
You know, you bring up a good point. I had the honor, very much, frankly, to have Alan and Marilyn Bergman on my show here a while back. And, of course, they wrote every contemporary song that was popular with Michel Legrand and all the great composers and so forth. Just down-to-earth people who just sit at their kitchen table, and they told me that, and they come up with the lyrics and so forth, and there you got an Academy Award-winning song.
Oh, I know. They're brilliant, and another one of my inspiration points.
You were one of the first groups to introduce the brass section. I remember Chicago did that a little later than you, but you brought the brass section into the band, which was very unusual at the time because everybody had drums, a guitar, and a bass.
Right. You know, mainly it started with the Ides of March wanting to do songs that we loved on the radio, like Soul Man and Sweet Soul Music by Arthur Connelly Jr., I Feel Good by James Brown. We added the brass to do those songs. And we started incorporating it into our original songs, too. There was a single on Parrot called My Foolish Pride. It's the first time we used brass. And we had a song called One Woman Man that we used the brass. And gradually, the arrangements got more and more complex. We added another trumpet. Soon we had the full section, and that's when I wrote Vehicle.
And you really don't have a band. It's an orchestra, basically.
You know, and we always get criticized, oh, they must... studio guys. No, we carried the brass.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun. You've played all the festivals in and around the area. You still do a lot of touring?
We do. You know, we probably do about 40, 45 dates a year. We do the fairs, we do the festivals, we do some corporate. Of course, we do some benefit shows. But, you know, it's not like the old days when I was with Survivor and I was gone for, you know, months and months and months on end with REO and, you know, Brian Adams, et cetera, et cetera. We play a lot of dates, but we play, you know, a very intelligent schedule, so we don't get totally burned out on it. And mentioning, by the way, this Paramount show, we're so looking forward to this. We've played this venue before, and it's just one of these classic theaters that sounds so good. But on the bill with Peter Noon, we played with Peter in Vegas at Bally's a few years ago on the bill with Peter, Chubby Checker, and the Turtles.
Oh, cool.
And I got to tell you, you know, not just because we're talking, Peter, to me, you know, pretty much, you know, had the audience. And they all did, but Peter is such an entertainer. I can't wait to see him again.
Well, of course, the Paramount is a great place, and Saturday, May 18th at 8 o'clock is going to be a great evening out at the Paramount Theater, 23 East Galena Boulevard in downtown Aurora. Well, Jimmy, as I said before, it's been a pleasure to spend some time chatting with you, and for myself and all our listeners and your fans, thanks so much for sharing your unique talents and gifts with all of us. I thank Scotty for putting us together, and always good to chat with a neighbor. I'm out in Burridge, much like yourself, and we'll have to stop and have a beer one of these evenings.
Oh, man, absolutely. There's so many great... joints around there. I'd love to do that.
Continued success, my pal. Always look forward to seeing you rocking and rolling.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me, and I will see you on the 18th.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Jimmy.
Great, man.
Jimmy Peterick, one of the great rock and rollers from the Chicago area, Berwyn, and the Ides of March. Great guy. Still enjoys it. You can tell the passion in his voice and certainly what he does. I thank Scott May for putting us together. But that, again, is at the Paramount Theater, Saturday, May 18th, 8 o'clock. Should be a terrific evening. For information, 630-896-6666. Tea with Edie and Fitz by Adam Pazin, directed by Artistic Director Jim Schneider. Now in its professional world premiere at the Greenhouse Theater Center in Chicago, 2257 North Lincoln, through June 6th. The Jazz Age and the Gilded Age collide in Tea with Edie and Fitz, a play that chronicles the tempestuous meeting of literary icons Edith Wharton and F. Scott Fitzgerald at her estate for tea in the 1920s. In scenes, jump backward and forward chronologically, and that span the entire globe, from glittering expatriate Paris, roaring post-World War I Manhattan. The play examines the lives of two authors at the height of their powers and imagines what may have happened in that meeting that led them to never speak again. Particular attention is also paid to Fitzgerald's relationship with his beautiful and troubled southern wife, Zelda, and Wharton's with the ghost of her mentor and longtime companion, Henry James, calling into question themes of gender, sanity, time, the purpose of art, and the nature of love and loss. And on the line with us right now is the graduate of both U of I and Northwestern Universities. Adam received his PhD from Western Michigan in English and playwriting, recipient of the Kennedy Center National Play Award. He has directed productions at City Lit, Remy Bumpo, and the Kennedy Center Theaters, accomplished actor of such roles in Tartuffe and The Drowsy Chaperone, teacher, mentor, one of the brightest young stars in the theater today, now presenting the professional world premiere of Tea with Edie and Fitz with the Dead Writers Theater Collective at the Greenhouse Theater, 225 North Lincoln, through June 6th, Mr. Adam Pazin. Adam, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
Great to have you. Great idea, and if I can quote one of Edith Wharton's editors, the meeting between F. Scott and Edith Wharton were described by your editors as one of the better-known failed encounters in the annals of American literary history.
That's true, although Fitzgerald actually has a long-standing tradition of having failed encounters with famous authors, including Theodore Dreiser and James Joyce, so not the first.
But what a unique and innovative idea to come up with this, and who knows, maybe that's what really happened, and who knows what they said. I mean, it didn't end up very well, but certainly it's timely now that we're going to have The Great Gatsby coming out here in a week or so and enjoying a resurgence in the work and the interest in the life of F. Scott.
Sure, and also a surprising resurgence in the interest of both Henry James and Edith Wharton as well. I know that the new Julianne Moore film, What Maisie Knew, that just came out in theaters, is based on his novella, and then Downton Abbey is based on Wharton's novel, The Custom of the Country. So it's actually an interesting resurgence in all the authors involved.
That was interesting. You know, we talk about the Jazz Age, you know, Paris in the 20s, the Roaring 20s, the suffrage movement comes out, and we talk about this came after the Gilded Age, which is the Reconstruction era around 1877 to the turn of the century, a term coined by Mark Twain, where, you know, we got two different types of people. We have Edith Wharton, who came from a very affluent upbringing in New York, and we have F. Scott, who was kind of an ordinary guy who aspired to that kind of lifestyle.
Exactly, the inverse of each other, right.
And you put this together, and you wonder what they talked about. What did they talk about, Adam?
Well, there are various different versions of the story, and we try to explore a few of those different accounts in the play itself. They seem to have talked about literature, and then at some point an off-color story was told about a young writer couple that ends up in a Paris bordello. And at some point after that, Fitzgerald left, and they never spoke again. Now, whether or not that was pointed and whether or not they meant to never speak again is open for debate, but we explore that a little bit in the show.
Henry James, did he put this whole deal together?
He was working behind the scenes from Evan, I'm sure he was. Absolutely.
Well, he was friends with Edith Wharton, of course, and I think he was probably a mentor to her.
Absolutely. Yes, without a doubt.
Of course, the great author of Daisy Miller and Turn of the Screw and Wings of a Dove, The Ambassadors, literary critic and so forth, very intelligent man, came from, a very affluent environment. And did Henry James have any interaction with F. Scott?
No, he did not. By the time F. Scott Fitzgerald was in vogue, Henry James had already passed away.
Okay.
unless he appeared to him as a ghost. I don't know.
Like he does in the play.
Like he doesn't.
That's right.
Well, he appears to someone, yeah.
Congratulations on your great success you've had there, of course, with the critical acclaim. What point do you want to get across? What story do you want to tell? What's some of the ideas you want that audience to come away with?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I really hope that audience members come away with a couple books from the library that they'd like to go check out. You know, I think it's an interesting time politically in America where essentially kind of a war has been waged on language, and you hear of all these books that are no longer in high school curriculums and being replaced by manuals. And what I love about Dead Writers so much is really just the commitment to books and reading and history and leading people back to that and finding love in words again. And I'm hoping that they'll fall in love with words a little bit too.
It's the responsibility, I think, of you as a teacher, certainly as a playwright, of the actors on the stage, of we as parents and professors and so forth, to stimulate and engage the audiences and the young people's enthusiasm, stimulate and engage their imagination and their intellect and their creativity. And I think that's what Dead Writers Collective does. That's what you are doing in this play, because you get enthusiastic about, well, you say, you know, I'm going to read a little bit about F. Scott, maybe before, but hopefully before, but maybe after, and certainly something a little more about Edith, and wonder how this idea could have come about.
Absolutely. And certainly when you speak about young people and the potential interest there for a new generation to be exposed to these works, I mean, I really hope so. I think seeing some of this stuff staged, seeing that in the 20s, you know, being a celebrity and being fabulous and wealthy and being at the center of these glittering parties and also being bookish and intelligent and smart and artistic are not mutually exclusive, that they can see that the celebrities, the cool kids, were the artists, you know, rather than kind of the celebrities we have today. You were famous based on what you produced rather than what you consumed, and that's really exciting to me.
Maybe F. Scott, as we're talking here, is more talented than we even give him credit for, because, first of all, he was an alcoholic. He was a very cocky guy. He experienced the corrosive effects of wealth and the decadent lifestyle which he lived with Zelda and so forth. And despite that, he was a great short story writer, certainly a great novelist. Is the best Great Gatsby the great American novel? I don't know, but he wrote The Sight of Paradise, Beautiful and the Damned, Tender as the Night, and didn't finish The Last Tycoon. Was it autobiographical? Had to be some of it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you think, there's a very, very famous quote, that I'm not going to quote correctly, but it is something about that you only have one or two stories in you. It's just how closely you tell that story and being committed to the themes that life has given to you. And I think for Fitzgerald, those themes of love and the common man's attempt to rise and better himself in a society that's essentially geared to destroy him, I think those ring true to so many people today and continue to.
You know, your background, of course, is in English and literature and so forth. Had you always wanted to write for the theater?
Okay. Well, when I was in junior high, I won a little contest in my class to write the sixth grade play. The prompt was write a play about candy. And so I wrote this play called Butterfinger about the exploits of James Bonbon. And
clever.
It won. Yeah, so that went up as my school's play. And playwriting kind of started then for me. I didn't think of it as an actual viable pursuit and certainly not a career until recently. But I acted for a while, and eventually I started wanting to write roles for myself. And it kind of originated like that.
Well, you were in The Drowsy Chaperone. That's a great musical. I love that.
It's a fantastic musical, and what I love so, I'm so glad you brought that up. What I love most about that show is it found a way to, they just don't make shows like they used to,
right?
But it found a way to take an old-time show and still place it in a modern context so that you could both engage with it as a modern, contemporary, current show that relates to you as a human today, but also has all those qualities that made us fall in love with theater in the first place, way back when it was about, you know, opulence and beauty. And I think those are elements that Dead Writers is kind of bringing back into the theater. What they value is beauty and laughter and creating art on the stage, and I think that's lovely.
Had the opportunity to have the press opening of Big Fish, which was a couple weeks ago. Have you seen that yet?
I've bartended at it.
Oh, did you?
I get to hear the wonderful vocals very often, which is always exciting to me.
It was an interesting story. It needs some tweaking, of course. Maybe it needs a good playwright there. I don't know, you know. But it was a great story and a great idea, very heartwarming. And, you look at it sometimes, we look at things as too critical of an eye. When you just sit back and enjoy the story and what they're trying to get across to the audience, you know? And
Of course, absolutely. Well, I mean, I know there are several, like, very, very talented playwrights involved in that production, and certainly there are so many other elements going on, music and dancing, that I can't even begin to fathom how you factor in trying to write the story with all that involved. But, yeah, I mean, from what I hear from audience feedback on that show, they've been very successful. I know with our show, we're trying to do the same thing. One goal of mine was to be educational, to be informative, to inform people about these amazing, iconic figures, Henry James, Zelda, F. Scott, and Edith, in a way that allows them to learn some stuff and see how relevant they are to their lives today, which, ironically and interestingly, there's so many references and citations kind of in the play. It's kind of similar to F. Scott Fitzgerald's first book, The Side of Paradise, which is also kind of similarly cited as kind of wavering back and forth in the style, going from fiction to poetry to scenes that are straight-up play passages, having a lot of references to famous people and other writers of the day and quotations. So I think, in a sense, I've kind of followed F. Scott's footsteps a little bit with this play, which is I didn't see that when I was writing it.
He'd be very proud.
He would. I hope he is proud of himself.
Have you had an opportunity for a talk back with the audience after the shows?
We did. We had a couple talkbacks during previews, which are always very informative and helpful.
Sure.
For me, because I'm very much a playwright that likes to work and tweak and improve and keep improving, that process really never stops. And there are so many things that I get tunnel vision when I'm writing that an audience's feedback can help so much. So, yes, that was very helpful and informative.
Well, it's a dynamic that's kind of interesting. What else is what's up next for Adam Payson?
Well,
a lot of things, I suppose, right?
Sure. A couple things. Let's see. There is a play that I wrote at the exact same time I was writing this play. I was writing a play called Badfic Love, which is kind of explores the theme of fan fiction from the point of view of a Harry Potter fanfic. And fan fiction is, you know, when a fan riffs on a popular story or tale or series of books. And it shares a lot of the same themes of appropriation, of the nature of art and the purpose of the writer, but from a very different and I think more youthful and vernacular point of view. So I'm kind of, I think I've done my erudite play that talks about history and sounds kind of bookish, and now I'm eager to get out there and show I can write young, too.
We'll look forward to that. Dead Writers Theater Collective is dedicated to the mantra that the playwright writer is the primary artist. Therefore, every aspect of the production radiates from this point. Our resurrected classics are presented after thorough, extensive dramaturgical research. As we interpret, the authors would have intended their works to be staged in the original period and setting. We are committed to bringing the aesthetic back to the classic through fully staged, period-accurate, and highly detailed masterpiece theater-style productions. Tea with Edie and Fitz by Adam Payson, directed by Artistic Director Jim Schneider, now in its professional world premiere at the Greenhouse Theater Center in Chicago, 2257 North Lincoln, through June 6th. On the line with us right now is the playwright Adam Payson. Adam, maybe a phone number or website if people would like to get some information?
Oh, gosh. My website is in the works. I will be getting that up soon.
Let me give our listeners the number of the theater, 773-404-7336. Delightful chatting with you. Continued success, and certainly with this play. We're going to talk with Jimmy soon about it also. And I'm so very happy for you. I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you, Kevin. It was wonderful being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Adam.
Take care. Bye.
Adam Payson, the playwright for Tea with Edie and Fitz. What a great concept, and certainly doing a great job with it. The Dead Writers Theater Collective at the Greenhouse Theater, 225 North Lincoln through June 6th. Against for tickets, 773-404-7336. Looking forward to talking to our next very special guest. On the line with us is the award-winning writer, best-selling author, scholar-in-residence at the Newbery Library, historian-in-residence at the Irish Fellowship Club of Chicago, contributor to Town and Country magazine, political speechwriter, former managing editor of World of Hibernia magazine, accomplished artist, and a true Renaissance man, now presenting an exhibition of his art and paintings entitled Modern Before the World Was at Kiki's Bistro, 900 North Franklin Street, on Monday, May 13th, from 5:30 to 7:30. My good friend, Mr. Tom O'Gorman. Tommy, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Kevin, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. And congratulations on another, I'm going to accent that, art exhibition at Kiki's.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You know, we were there the other night with dinner. It's always good to see you. And I don't know what style. I saw a little bit of impressionism with some of the still lifes, which you had the paintings of the flowers. But then I saw a little expressionist kind of surrealism in some of the portraits you had.
There is. It kind of moves between them. I always say to people that I'm an anti-impressionist with Irish proclivities. I've become more expressionistic, although I still have form in my work. I mean, a house is a house. It doesn't look like a fish, you know.
Sure.
My style. Everybody's style is kind of an evolving thing. I suspect because it contains so much architectural material. I do a lot of 18th century houses and things like that, and so because of that, I kind of remain true to some of the form of 18th century architecture, and as a result, it kind of keeps me more form conscious. When I do portraits and when I do a few other landscapes and cityscapes, I tend to be a little more give myself a little more freedom.
You know, as I said in the introduction, you are a Renaissance man. When did you take up painting? Had you always painted, even when we were young?
Yes, I did. I painted as a child. I painted in high school. And then I really didn't pursue it formally or academically. And I did, however, pursue writing. And I kind of came back to painting about 12, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and mostly for my own enjoyment. And then I was producing a lot of material, and I then began to have some exhibitions, and people liked what I was doing. That's kind of an interesting experience, because you don't do it for that reason, but it's kind of one of the side effects of what you do.
Kind of validates what you're doing, that's right. Of course, I remember you doing graffiti at the Viaduct at 55th and Damon by St. Pat, but that was a different type of art, I think.
Well, that's like fashionable these
days. That's right. And, of course, you're a very successful writer with Ed Burke, of course, the Dean Laureate Alderman in the Chicago, but you've written many, many books.
I have. With Chairman Burke, I did a serious look at all the Chicago police been killed in the line of duty from the 1840s to the present. And then we also did a book on the City Hall building, which turned 100 about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, I've always written about architecture, and I did a biography of Frank Lloyd Wright. And so architecture and then history. So I've done some local Chicago history, and I've done a lot of Irish history as well. I'm a citizen of the Republic as well, of Ireland as well as the United States. And I've always had that dual citizenship, and as a result, I spent a lot of time living in Ireland. And I think I think my work reflects, my painting particularly, and of course my writing. And both these things, by the way, I don't believe that you decide to be either a writer or a painter. I think you decide to pursue it formally or academically, but I think you are born, both writers and painters are born. And I think that's an interesting, I look at it as a gift, and in fact, at this stage of my life, I'm really obsessed with the painting dimension of it all.
The title of the exhibition, Modern Before the World Was, what does that represent?
Well, you know, it's very much tied to the subject matter of many of the paintings, and that is 18th century architecture. Ireland was a very had a very successful and prosperous architectural blossoming in the 18th century. It had a great deal of freedom, and many people were building great country houses for themselves, as well as then in Dublin, the capital, they were building townhouses for themselves. And some of the finest architects in Europe were, and I always say this to Irish people. They were building these great houses. They were constructed by Irish people, and the art, the design, the incidentals of the house, they were all an Irish art. And so it flourished. And then when when the Parliament moved to Westminster in London in the 19th century, in 1803, many people left Dublin to go be in Parliament there, and they left their houses in Dublin to estate agents and said, you know, rented it for as much as you can get. So instead of one elegant family living in this house, they put like maybe 30 families into it. Hmm. And so through the 19th century, they became tenements. But the remarkable thing is this architecture is so extraordinarily good and solid that these houses are still standing. They didn't fall apart. And so these are the buildings that currently, when the Irish had money until the market changed, but the people buy now and renovate, you know, if you're a physician or a barrister in Dublin, that's what you're looking for, a house to redo. And my point is that this was fast-paced, modern design in the 18th century. And when you cross the threshold of one of those places, still there, they're very prevalent across Dublin, when you walk in there, you're moved 3 centuries into the past. You know?
So there's an urban regentrification in Dublin and Ireland, much as we have in Chicago.
Yes, very, very solid. And some Americans are part of that as well. But the point being that, you know, modernity is a relative term, but, you know, these were the great modern expressions of art and design, functionality and architecture, centuries ago, and it's probably still the finest in Europe.
Interesting, because like I say, having that interest in architecture and art now, it kind of goes hand in hand. You're kind of chronicling, just as you said, what happened 200 or 300 years ago that all of a sudden isn't old anymore. It's new again.
Yes, exactly. It's also interesting. There's sections of the paintings that I'm going to show this time. During the struggle for independent nationhood in Ireland at the beginning of this century, particularly from 1916 on, about 2,000 or 3,000 of these great country houses were destroyed.
Wow.
And they were just erased from the landscape. They were burnt by well-meaning and well-intentioned people, often on bad information. And so in some of these paintings, this is where I get very expressionist, that I don't paint what there was. I reconstitute it. I don't reconstruct it. But it is an interesting thing to put those elements together in a thing and remember those houses because, you know, many people now, because they work at Downton Abbey, they're familiar with this. So these things weren't just houses. They were cities among themselves. You know, they were self-sufficient. They provided food and shelter and employment for thousands of people. Each one of these houses.
Well, you'll be receiving your guests at the Kiki's Bistro, 900 North Franklin, this Monday from 5:30 to 7:30. And, of course, your paintings, of course, are all for sale. And will you do some private commissioning?
Yes, of course I will, especially for portraits. I love to paint portraits.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, sometimes the public gets frightened of art exhibitions. They think they're going to buy something. Secondly, they think they're going to get fleeced. I really try to keep my paintings very moderate.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather sell a painting way undervalued to get it into somebody's hands, you know?
And I think it's important that one thing about Tommy O'Gorman, he's accessible, you know? He is a Renaissance man, but he's accessible, and you're willing to talk to those people that come out and see you and chat give your ideas.
And Kiki's is a wonderful venue, and any of your listeners that would be interested in coming should just show up 900 North Franklin. And, I mean, Kiki puts out wonderful French wines and hors d'oeuvres and things like that, and they're very personable. It's a great, in the great tradition of the French. He does a wonderful job.
Great restaurant. Always a pleasure, my pal. Keep me tuned in. If people would want to contact you, you have an email or a website?
I can give an email, and that is, it's T-O-G, my initials, T-O-G, 515. At gmail.com.
Beautiful. So if people see something or they want to kind of contact you and talk about the paintings or the books, they can do that.
Great.
Always a pleasure, my pal,
thanks
and
so much, Kevin.
Look forward to seeing you soon and continue success.
Thanks. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my pal. Tommy O'Gorman, one of the very accomplished artists, writer, and truly a Renaissance man. And certainly always good to chat with him. Modern Before the World Was at Kiki's Bistro, 900 North Franklin Street on Monday, May 13th from 5:30 to 7:30. And contact Tom at TOG515@gmail.com. One last essay from Jack Spadafora about moms, titled Cherishing Mom's Lingering Scent. There are a great many closed doors in our lives, doors we still don't know how to unlock, doors we once unlocked but then closed behind us, plus a few doors we may have just taken for granted. For example, Mother's Day in general and our mothers in particular. Let's start with the assumption most of us love our mothers. Fine. But there's more to our mother than that. So much more that you better start peeking through that door before it's too late. You see, our mother, for all her possible faults, has been vastly more than the body that bore us, the hands that fed us, and the little sweater she had us wear whenever she got chilly. Mom was the instrument by which we got in direct touch with God, for she allowed us to experience the incredible act of creation. Because of her, we got a chance to step onto this cosmic stage and play our little role in the great drama of life. Let's hope we didn't blow too many of our lines to disappoint her. Mom also gave us our very first compliment, for rather than abort us, she permitted us to move from her womb into our world. She and Frank Capra were right, because it's mostly been a wonderful life ever since. Mom then laid on some pretty good lessons along the way, like don't forget to wash behind your ears, eat your vegetables, sit up straight, remember not to poke your eye out, and come over here and give me a big kiss. Now, dads are perfectly fine, but let's be honest. Their contribution to this affair mostly comes down to a few squiggly sperm, how to ride a bike, where to come for tuition, and the eternal advice of, go ask your mother. Possibly, their greatest contribution has been to let you see how they love your mother. As I study the lilac bushes in our backyard, I'm always confident they'll bloom in time for Mother's Day. All across the Midwest, they rarely fail to deliver, and as they open, they always help me remember the enduring phenomenon known as motherhood. No matter how dark the winters, how cold the days, or how much effort it takes, they seem never to fail to be there. I will snip a few of these lilac branches and bring them into the house, but they fade quickly. It's as if to say, enjoy my faithfulness for as long as you can, but remember, I cannot remain with you forever. Fortunately for us, their fragrance can. From Jack Spadafora. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Jim Peterick, who will be with Herman's Hermits at the Paramount Theater, Saturday, May 18th at 8 o'clock. The Ides of March. For information, 630-896-6666. Jimmy, keep on rocking and rolling. Adam Pazin, the very talented playwright of the hit show Tea with Edie and Fitz with the Dead Writers Theater Collective at the Greenhouse Theater, 225 North Lincoln through June 6th. For information, 773-404-7336. And always a pleasure to talk with our good pal Tommy O'Gorman, a true Renaissance man. His new art exhibition, Modern Before the World Was, at Kiki's Bistro, 900 North Franklin Street on Monday, May 13th from 5:30 to 7:30. Contact Tommy at his email, TOG515@gmail.com. Finally, a famous writer once said one ought, every day at least, to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day, Mom, wherever you're at. And happy Mother's Day to my beloved wife from her husband and all her children. Have a great day. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid.
in your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music.